The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
All right. In the last class, we looked at the architecture and urbanism of the world as it was known to the Mongolians. And during that class, I had introduced Janet Abulugod's idea that a pre-modern world system existed circa 1300. And just to refresh your memory, I thought I'd put up the excerpt that I showed the last time as well. And I think in our continuing effort to understand the architectural and geographic dimensions of Abulugod's assertion that I'm showing here on slide number two, that circa 1300, the globe was integrated through exchange in unprecedented ways, we want to today examine port cities. And specifically, we will look at ports on the Indian Ocean that facilitated global exchange and this is sort of important for today, and nurtured new tastes for luxuries and ornaments like silk and porcelain. Now, on slide number three, I've added to the slide that we began with cities in yellow that constitute the major global ports circa 1300 across the Indian Ocean region, which is to say not just ports that were necessarily on the Indian Ocean, but certainly also ports like Alexandria and Guangzhou, referred to in subsequent European accounts as Canton, that certainly were connected in the network of Indian Ocean area trade. Now, besides thinking about the architectural connections and social relationships across these ports, it is important to analyze the relationship between ports and non-coastal centers of power, commerce, and production. And I'm thinking here of specifically the relationship that emerges around the early part of the 1200s between Kish, Hormuz, and Shiraz, which at that time was newly emerging as a center of political and commercial power. I also just want to say that what I've tried to do through this map is indicate that most cities in the Indian Ocean region on the coast were in fact spatially rather small, and it's really only a few places like Alexandria that we get that are significantly different in scale. I think no less important are the connections between ports and places of pilgrimage. And while the map on slide number four is not intended as an exhaustive list of major religious sites in the 14th century, it does list places that we know influential traders visited, in some cases routinely. Mecca, for example, was the site of a large market in the mid-14th century, and numerous traders journeyed from Cairo, or Fustat, as it was known then, via Suez to Jeddah, and then overland to Mecca for religious and commercial purposes. So what preliminary inferences can we draw from this specific example of Mecca? So let us begin our work today by trying to define port cities as hubs that connect to non-coastal markets, landmarks, and production centers, as zones of commerce that are linked to one another. And what I mean by zones of commerce is that it's not always just the jetty on the water that makes a port a port. It's also the relationships that exist in the immediate region surrounding that coastal settlement that allows for certain places we find to emerge as a port city of global consequence. And finally, the third point, or the third defining characteristic might seem a little abstract, but I'll try and give as concrete an example as I can, is that politically, port cities are not just any other town or village in a kingdom. They seem to have a very special relationship to, say, the capital of a kingdom or even other cities or other places in a given place or state. For example, we know that in many cases in the Indian Ocean region, ports were often autonomous, but in all kinds of tributary relationships with certain centers of power. The main point that I want to, however, emphasize in this effort to define a global port city is that it's not just a city on the water. We do not want to indulge in the myth of geographic determinism. If that were true, then the entire coastline of East Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, the Deccan, and Southeast Asia would have been littered with port cities. And yet we know this is not the case circa 1300. And if we look specifically at a mid-20th century archaeological mapping of settlements on the East African coast on slide number 6 on the left-hand side, we see that, in fact, there were settlements all throughout the coast region. And that's really an enlargement just of this area. And yet we find no evidence of a major urban settlement devoted to global trade, except for a place like Kilwa, which is one of our case studies for today. Moreover, we find that not all port cities were equal. Some were more important than others, even though the same sailors and merchants visited both major and minor ports. Throughout this class, we will want to return to this question then. Why were some port cities architecturally grander or more commercially important than others? And the best I could do to, in some senses, suggest the hierarchy between major and minor global ports was on slide number 7 to provide these dashed circles around the cities that we know from travel accounts and from records pertaining to merchants from the 12th and 13th century, that these, in fact, seem to have been the major zones of international exchange. Now, a lot of what we know about this part of the world and from this time period comes to us from economic and social histories of the Indian Ocean. That branch of history refers to this trade as the dhow trade, a dhow being the particular kind of sailboat used by Arab merchants and sailors at this time to navigate the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea. And here on slide number 8 on the left-hand side, we have a 13th century illustration from manuscript, Al-Hariri's Maqamat. And I'm grateful to Anika Lenson for helping me decipher this particular manuscript. It's believed to have been illustrated by somebody from the town of Wastit, and that's why it says by Al-Wastiti, and Wastit itself was a minor a trading post inland in between, just sort of off Basra to on the route to Baghdad. So in all likelihood, Al-Wastiti, whoever he may have been deeply familiar with what a dhow was, although some later historians have pointed to certain inaccuracies in this particular illustration. The only thing I wanted to point to was the presence of the merchant figures in this illustration itself. And on the right-hand side, on the same slide, we have a contemporary sort of 20th century photograph of a dhow docked in Kuwait. Now, how did these boats get across? For this, some attention to geography actually would be helpful. The monsoons, the word itself derived from the Arabic mausim, meaning weather, are periodic winds. And on slide number 9, this taken from Janet Abu Lugod's book, I show how, or she shows how, in fact, the winds move in the summer from the high-pressure area off the Indian Ocean onto the landmass, which is a low-pressure area, and then reverse in the winter. Now, the implication of all of these patterns appears to be that the trade routes followed by merchants and sailors at this time tended to stick fairly close to the coastline. And there's some backup of our surmise of this in the form of travel accounts from the 13th and 14th centuries. Now, drawing on translations of these travel accounts, as well as later studies of standing buildings, we will look in depth at 4 ports. Each case is architecturally and historically distinct, although all 4 were visited by the same merchants, clerics, and sailors during this time period. And our 4 principal case studies are, I'm on slide number 11 now, Kilwa in East Africa, Cambay, situated really at the head of the Gulf of Cambay, Mangalore, situated in the Deccan Peninsula, and Majapahit in Southeast Asia, in the island based out of or centered on the island of Java. Starting then with Kilwa, which, and I've sort of held on to the map with all the cities over here, so we have some thumbnail guide, Kilwa located here off the coast of modern-day Tanzania. Cuba, in fact, is a remarkably small island, as you can see. And what we have with it is a powerful entreport or trading post where merchandise was imported and re-exported, each such transaction profiting Kilwa's small trading and ruling community. It's also thought that Kilwa, on account of its military might, was able to preserve its position as the key point on the trade route of Southern African gold coming from Sofala and heading up towards Hadramat, the Rasulid kingdom of Hadramat here in present-day Aden, but certainly also to Mamluk Egypt, both of which had a tremendous taste for gold. Now, as I suggested, it's a rather small island, and even more interestingly than that for me was that it's really less than about 4 square kilometers of this island that appear to have been settled as an anthropoid in the 13th century, although there is some evidence that there was outlying agrarian and fishing settlements as well on the same island. And our main interest for today in terms of 12th and 13th century or even 14th century structures is the Great Mosque of Kilwa, shown here on slide 13 with the red outline. But certainly there are other structures here of historical note from later periods that people have paid considerable attention to, the fort and the Makatuni complex there. Now, the oldest sections of the Great Mosque of Kilwa date back to the 11th century, to when the ruling elite of Kilwa may have been Shia'i rather than Sunni. And the oldest sections, if you're with me on slide 14, is really this part here. It's rather narrow, subsequently enlarged around the 14th century. These are the original paving stones that seem to date back to the very early 11th century, possibly even, there's some dispute, but possibly even the late 10th century. And here we have a plan for the Great Mosque that allows us to understand the different phases of building activity, the darkest lines representing the work that was first commenced in the 11th century. This larger southern extension, so labeled, the larger prayer hall, actually comes from the 14th century, although in the form that we find the ruin today, Kilwa was discovered in 1955 by British archaeologists. And what they in fact found was a 15th century reconstruction where stone pillars had replaced the coral block that had been used originally to build the columns or pillars that we see here in plan. What's interesting about coral construction, and here is a photograph on the left of slide 16 of the Great Mosque itself with the coral blocks, is that this particular construction style or method is more generally associated with an architectural surveys to the red seaport town of Suakin, present-day Sudan. Right immediately adjacent to the immediate south of the Great Mosque is the Great House. And I'm not really going to spend any amount of time describing the Great House, but I just want to say that from its footprint and from the archaeological remnants that were found on the site, scholars have come to believe that this structure was probably home to a powerful merchant family, and that in fact the oldest parts of the structure date back to the 14th century, and that it was in continuous use, it would appear, up until the 16th century. I'm certainly intrigued, but was unable to find any definitive evidence to suggest that the presence of a merchant family so close to the main congregational mosque, in fact, might suggest that the mosque itself was somehow institutionally connected to mercantile activity, but there's no real backup evidence for that. I just want to briefly turn, so all that we looked at, if you're with me on slide 18, all we had looked at was sort of just in this area, this sort of westernmost tip of the island of Kilwa. What I want to do now is briefly turn to structures that are here in this part of the island, and specifically to the Husseini Kubwa complex, although it should be noted that there's another older 12th century structure here, Husseini Dogo, which I just find remarkable, not least of all because of its planned condition. But again, we know so little about it that it's hard to really make a sensible story out of it. On the other hand, Husseini Kubwa is a truly remarkable, strange, but certainly at the very least wonderful story. The collective best guess on Husseini Kubwa was that it accommodated a complex mix of public, private, and commercial programs. This may, for example, have very well been where Ibn Battuta stayed when he visited Kilwa in 1331. In stark contrast to the other landmarks at in Kilwa on this island, the Husseini Kubwa has no columns. The roofing structure is supported instead by load-bearing walls, which I think is quite interesting. And unprecedented. You don't find any other structure that survives, at least on the island, that uses that tectonic system. It's possible that work on the complex was never completed, and that in all likelihood the site was altogether abandoned sometime after 1335, when the Sultan, who was the building's patron, died. And what's interesting, I describe this sort of mix of commercial, public, and private programs within the complex. Here you have these two different courts that are used in a variety of ways for political as well as for trading purposes, a palace court used much more privately, and then a south court, which was more connected with the storage facilities that form a part of Husseini Kubwa. And the word Husseini, or its root, the root Husseini in the word Husseini, probably referred to the strength of its fortification. And I particularly like this reconstruction and model, because you can just sort of imagine pulling up in one of those small dhows and sort of seeing this immense structure strung along this raised embankment, as it were. It must have been quite a sight, if not formidable and daunting in some ways. Now, this is an axonometric reconstruction done a few decades ago by archaeologists of the Husseini Kubwa complex, based mostly on ruins, particularly the roofing system, which is really an interesting hodgepodge of different schemes, had collapsed, and sort of where it's collapsed in, they've sort of extrapolated out and drawn up the axonometric that we see on slide 21. The palace's ornamental pool, this one here, has been likened to a form found in Mamluk Egypt. The conical domes have been likened to 10-shaped ones found in Persia and Seljuk Turkey. And I bring all this up just to say that if any of these connections bear out, how should we think about that? Should it be interpreted as evidence of globe-trotting architects? Or does it prove that Kilwa's elite, through trade and travel, were aware of architectural wonders in distant metropolises? Or was it a 14th-century architectural attempt by Kilwa's elite to claim Persian ancestry? Ultimately, we can be much surer about the import and deployment of luxury ornaments like the Yuan vase and porcelain found amongst Kilwa's remnants than we can be about any of the questions that might explain the particular fashioning of the Husseini Kubwa complex. What I suggest is that new tastes like the Rasulid and Mamluk taste for gold, or the taste for porcelain, and this here is blue and white pottery from Iran, Yuan vase, that the taste for these items, in fact, is what drives sea trade. My point is distinct from the idea that increased exchange or the globalization of trade created surpluses that were converted into domestic luxuries. Rather, in Kilwa and in the other cities we will visit today, textiles facilitated trade. To paraphrase one of my favorite characters, An Ugly Betty, in the medieval, fashion was currency. I'm just thinking of the original scene. Sort of continuing with our survey, Don, I want to now move, in fact, to Cambay. And here we have a satellite image of the Gulf of Cambay with the modern city of Kambat or Cambay located here. And I think part of what this satellite image composes, it is, in fact, of different sheets, helps us understand is that this area has now largely silted. And that all that we see here particularly, in fact, was water in the 13th and 14th and even up to the 15th century. And this is, in fact, what made Kambat, in Marco Polo's words, one of the largest and most magnificent ports that he'd ever been to. And writing a few decades later, Ibn Battuta said much the same thing. It's actually still a very small town. I mean, its footprint is not even covered by the generic icon thrown on by Google Earth. And one can only imagine that the 13th century town was smaller. Now, what's interesting about Cambay is that it was certainly connected to the Delhi Sultanate, but it's not clear that it was directly ruled by it in the 13th century. And we want to return to this theme a couple of times. The principal building that I want to talk about here is the Jame Masjid, the Friday Congregational Mosque. And again, just sort of look at the topographical, geographical detail here, we can be quite sure that the waterfront was actually quite close to where the Jame Masjid had been built in 1325, if you look at your slide list. We're on slide number 24. This is by far the most widely documented landmark in Cambay, and although built or the one that we look at is built in 1325, it was probably not the first Jami or Friday mosque in the city. It's, I think, most prominent features might be this central courtyard and the roofing system, which consists of 21 domes, supported by 156 columns and 70 pilasters, all of which rise to 15 feet, and we'll see some photographs and plans of this. This is a relatively recent photograph taken by an architectural historian who completed her dissertation at Harvard a few years ago. And so here you get a sense of the extent to which light and air comes in to these colonnaded walkway spaces precisely because, in fact, they rise to 15 feet. And here on slide number 26, we have a plan, and here we have the columns, and this is what I say, totals up to 156, and the pilasters back on the wall, like so. The area on this slide, denoted by the red dashed line, is the enclosure for the Al-Khazaruni tomb, and this, in fact, in the center is his tomb from 1333. And the one adjacent to it is his daughter's from 1381. Give you a sense of the courtyard. The photograph on slide number 27 on the left is an archival photograph taken by the great or notorious, depending on your perspective, archaeologist Henry Cousins. And I think it sort of luckily gives us a very good sense of what we see in plan, this structure being what we see here, that's that, and that previous photograph that I had shown you of the colonnade was sort of taken looking that way. Just one last architectural feature to point out is this portico. This sort of becomes important for our understanding, not just of the building, but of architectural and commercial culture in Cambay, circa 1300. Now, architectural historians, drawing partly on in Arabic inscriptions and partly on formal analysis of the building, including the portico and ceilings, have suggested that this mosque was in part a reconstruction of a 12th century mosque on the same site. And here you actually have ceiling fragments dating not as far back as the 12th century, but according to Alka Patel, who was the former doctoral student at Harvard that I referenced earlier, quite definitively dates it to the 13th century. I pulled up translations of two inscriptions from two different mosques found in Cambay, mostly because I think it gives us a tremendous way to understand the nature of patronage in a port city like Cambay, with its particular kind of links to the Delhi Sultanate, but also to global trade and to places like Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. Some of the key things I think to pay attention to is that it is a bequest of personal, or one might translate it as private property, and that a certain kind of relationship between the merchant and the sultan is expressed in these passages. I also just absolutely love the second inscription, which sort of ends with the prayer for the architect. And I imagine that Frank Gehry would just love it if Susan Hockfield would pray for him occasionally. I think that these inscriptions prove that it was merchants rather than sultans who were the patrons for at least the major mosques that we have in the 14th century in Cambay specifically. I think they also, like I said, expressed this relationship of benefactor and beneficiary that existed between the sultan and the merchant. And I sort of bring all this up because, unfortunately, within standard South Asian architectural history, Cambay is portrayed as a Muslim town. And so thus, you know, despite the significant presence of non-Muslim merchant groups in the 14th century, or the fact that Muslim merchant groups other than the state are patronizing architecture, despite both these things, all architectural surveys tend to focus exclusively on the city's mosques and sort of exclusively trying to attribute them to the state, even when the epigraphic evidence so clearly points to the fact that they were built by merchants. To just sort of reinforce this point of that, in fact, continuing in the 13th and 14th centuries to exist a tremendously vibrant iconographic and architectural practice associated with non-Muslim merchant groups, Hindu and Jain merchants specifically, I want to show this early 13th century portrait depicting a family of merchants. And this portrait was installed at a shrine that they supported in Cambay. And sadly, the shrine has not been documented at all. We have nothing by way of an architectural drawing to make any sense of it. And I was particularly disheartened when I discovered that I simply could not even locate, using Google Earth, the city Shantinath Temple, which housed one of the earliest Jain Grantha Bhandars, or scripture storerooms, that was ever built. The best I was able to do, and we're on slide 31, was to locate copies of the only illustrations found amongst the Grantha Bhandar's scriptural and literary texts. Now, a Grantha Bhandar is a bit like our very own library storage annex at MIT. It's a storage room that nobody really sees, but if you wanted to consult, if you were an ascetic or a monk and you wanted to consult a rare manuscript, there was a way in which you could page it. This is an entirely new program in the late 12th century. There's no evidence of Jains or really anybody else in this region having previously stored so many manuscripts in a single place. And in fact, there is no extant Jain manuscript dating to before the 11th century at all. Now, although the Yazimbek and Prakash textbook does not exclusively deal with medieval port cities, its year 1000 chapter introduces us to Jainism and describes Jains as an important mercantile community. I found this section a little troubling. For one, there's a large body of Jain iconography and architecture from preceding periods, notably at Ellora. So in other words, if there were to be some kind of introduction of Jainisms or Jains, the year 1000 doesn't necessarily feel like the best place to have done it. But moreover, I would suggest that a global history of architecture should avoid organizing information into civilizational categories in the first place. Nonetheless, I want to make sure that we do cover a few giant sites that bear on our understanding of global port cities. And for that, we move to the Deccan, and specifically to the area that constitutes what we now politically refer to as Karnataka. And while it's not a coastal town, and while it was never a hub in global trade, the Jain complex at Shravanbelgola is important to coastal Karnataka, and I will describe how so. And it is featured quite prominently in the Azambek and Prakash textbook that we use. Now, we're at slide 34, and by far the most well-known, and some might say significant, element within the complex of Jain shrines at Shravanbelgola is the statue of Bahubali, carved out of single stone around 981 AD. At 57 feet, it's probably the most widely known Bahubali statue there is in the world. Now, the statue shows Bahubali in a meditative pose, his clothes having withered away and creepers beginning to climb up his limbs. In Jain epic literature, Bahubali's renunciation followed a battle between him and his elder brother over their kingdom and wealth. While fighting, as Bahubali raised his arm to strike his brother, he realized the folly of fighting his own brother over land, wealth, and power. And so instead of striking him and killing him, essentially, he raised his arm and removed his hair. Now, renunciation during or immediately after a battle, and in the Bahubali epic, renunciation is sort of inaugurated by this ad hoc tonsure ceremony that he conducts, is a key trope in Jain heroic literature. And I think that in sculpture, what we have is Bahubali presented naked, that is victorious over his desire for wealth and power, and thus appears to us as the paradigmatic hero. As I suggested, the Shravanbelgola complex is much more than just the statue, and sort of a very overcast shot, but that's sort of it. Actually, the complex consists of three different hills that have a variety of shrines, and also sort of this, for example, here on slide 35 on the lower right corner is a wall painting that depicts the Jain cosmology. The site is perhaps best known in popular imagination for the Mahamastak Abhisheka ceremony, which is when devotees bathe and anoint the statue with milk, water, sugarcane, juice, turmeric, saffron, vermilion, and sandalwood. Offerings of gold and silver coins are also made at this point, and more recently, a helicopter will sort of shower petals over it. That will sort of all adds to the contemporary spectacle. Now, the ceremony is held every 12 years, with the first one dating back to the 11th century, and the most recent one was held in 2006. I actually just love these photographs just because of the color, you know, sort of working with plans that were drawn in the 1950s and 60s. They tend to have yellowed, and that's the only color you see. But, you know, here with the vermilion and turmeric, these colors are quite something to look at. This woman here is performing her last rite as in her secular life. She will become a nun when she completes the ceremony. And this is not the same woman, but this is, in fact, a Jain monk or nun praying at the feet of the Bahubali statue just days before the last Mahamastak Abhisheka ceremony. The other thing about these photographs that I really like, and I'll have another one that's going to help us even more, is it shows us quite clearly the prominence of these inscriptions. And in fact, there are more than 800 inscriptions from across the 10th to about the 14th century, 15th century in at Shravanbelgola. And I think what makes the ones at the Bahubali feet particularly important, not just for literary and cultural history, but also for our purposes in our attempt to do a global survey of what a port city was at this time period, is less the content of the inscription, which just translates to Chamundaraya made this, and Chamundaraya was a minister in the kingdom that patronized the construction of the statue, but really that it was inscribed in three different languages using four different scripts. And that this act of inscription marked the inauguration of a very new political and social imagination. Whereas for the previous 10 centuries, courts like the one Chamundaraya had belonged to had used and patronized Sanskrit literature exclusively, starting somewhere around the 10th century, multiple desh bhashas, or languages of place, began to be used in place of Sanskrit. And while it's impossible to give a singular account of the shift in this practice, the so-called vernacularization, that incidentally is taking place at about the same time the vernacularization of Europe is taking place, which itself might be worth another kind of global study. So while it's impossible to really provide a singular account of vernacularization, we know for sure that global trade and the emergence of highly localized centers of power in this period are a part of the story, are a part of why not one, as it is in the sort of 19th century embrace of vernaculars for the purposes of modern nationalism, but in fact multiple languages of place come to be used in court, which had otherwise up until then been singly using Sanskrit. And it is within the architectural story of the emergence of localized centers of power within a global system that we find ourselves visiting Karkal and Mudbidri, still within the Deccan area, in the sort of area just immediately adjacent to the Mangalore port. And you remember that I said that Mangalore was sort of a third case study. And it's really a case of what I call a zone of commerce. And I'll do a better job of defining that. So it was in the agricultural lands that surround Karkal and Mudbidri that native Tulu-speaking merchants would buy produce to then sell to Arabic-speaking merchants based in Mangalore. Tulunad, literally meaning the land of Tulu-speaking people, and the term generally applied to the Mangalore area, is a good example of a globally linked zone of commerce. When we looked at the Jame Masjid in Cambay, I had pointed to the patronal role of merchants in the 14th century in that particular city. I want to now focus on other ways in which different religious institutions intersected with the crisscross of global trade. We know for sure that mosques constituted a network of credit and social infrastructure that nurtured seafaring and overland trade. And I suspect something similar can be said of the sites, the Jain shrines, at Karkal and Mudbidri. And now, basically, from slides 39 to 45, we're going to watch television. We're just going to sail through this really quickly. These are mostly, in fact, sites that are from the 15th and 16th century. These are the most interesting ones are. But there were certainly significant sites now more or less ruined from the 11th through 14th centuries. They were built by Jain merchants. They were built on land owned and donated by Jain merchants. And it is in the repositories of these places that we find documents related to trade that begin to suggest that temples, but certainly also religious schools, all supported trade in a variety of ways, perhaps even serving as vehicles of credit and investment. This is, in fact, a second Bahubali statue, and this is sort of it from the Google Sat image, and it's not as tall as the one in Shravan Belgola, but is built in the late 14th century by a local merchant who owned the land to rival that other place of pilgrimage. And subsequently, in the sort of mid to late 15th century, we have this rather interesting structure of the Chaturmukh Basadi, unprecedented at its time in the region. I wanted to show you one, again, religious complex, but this time not Jain, but rather Vaishnav, on closer to the coastline in the area around Udpi. And again, I'll just watch this, I think, as television. Oh, this is Mudbidri, sorry. I should have shown you these images earlier. All of these roof structures over here are, in fact, Jain sites, many of them dating back to the 12th and 13th century. Mudbidri's thousand-pillar temple is later, but certainly interesting architecturally. And these are taken from the Granth Bhandar or storeroom from that 1,000-pillar temple. And I want to call sort of particular attention to this palm leaf manuscript, which depicts Bahubali. And you can already see the creepers sort of coming up. And that illustration would have been done about the same time as the statue, maybe about 100 years later. So this is the complex in Udpi. It has, again, a variety of programs that are situated within the complex. One of the more interesting things, I think, to talk about for our purposes is the history attributed to the central Krishna icon in the Ananteshwar temple within the complex, is that it was found on a beach by the founder of the particular sect that this complex forms the sort of architectural center of. And the legend is that it was rescued from a shipwreck and that the icon originated from Gujarat, from the Gulf of Cambay, in fact. And this is very much the nature of trade, that in fact does not occur overland at this point in time, precisely for artifacts like religious idols. In fact, comes by a sea route, even when it's just coming from the Gulf of Cambay to the Deccan. The other thing to say about this complex is that unlike all the other buildings that we've looked at so far, this one is principally a timber structure, and sadly one that has not been adequately studied architecturally. This complex is probably best known, at least within the region, if not more globally. The blonde hair can evince that. A particular festival that takes place in the middle of January every year, in which these chariots, this one dating back to the 15th century, are actually pulled around the complex on a street appropriately named Car Street. And, you know, part of my interest in even bringing up any of these sites, the Jain ones as well as the Vaishnav ones, is there's an active theorizing of beauty that is taking place at this time in these religious contexts rather than courtly contexts. And beauty is being actively theorized by ascetics and monks. And I think that there's a rich set of studies that could be done on the relationship between that sort of theorizing of the aesthetic and, in fact, the material culture that we find in the Mangalore port around this time, particularly its the sort of vast or wide prevalence of things like Chinese silk and other fabrics and other luxury items at the just domestic level itself. And so our final case study today comes from Sumatra and Java and is perhaps going to be the least satisfying, and I know that's not the best note to end on. At the beginning of the class, I suggested that port cities were a distinct political type. Kilwa was probably a single island state. Cambay and the many towns of Tulunad were certainly related to the Delhi Sultanate and the Vijayanagar Empire, respectively, but seemed to have retained a fair measure of autonomy. However, it does not seem that 14th century Cambay had substantial military resources of its own, unlike Kilwa. And by contrast, also, boats approaching the Mangalore port appear to have been regularly attacked by pirates, and travel accounts from the period provide some sense that local chieftains were only able to provide sporadic protection from something like piracy. Now, the Sri Vijaya kingdom of early medieval Sumatra, on the other hand, offers an interesting comparative story. The kingdom included a network of small ports along the east coast of Sumatra from Pasai to Jambi, which is here, which were, it would seem, all controlled independently of each other and from Palembang, which was an inland center of political power and the capital of Srivijaya up until the 11th century. What we seem to know from, or our best guess using epigraphic evidence, is that each port was controlled by a local military functionary of the Srivijaya kingdom, who may or may not have also been a landowner or a merchant. You have some cases in which their title very clearly refers to the fact that they were occupying two stations, military chief and merchant, or military chief and landowner. And so coming to our last couple of slides, 54 and 55, we see that this sort of relationship between the political center and trading periphery was maintained by the later Majapahit kingdom of Java. In fact, the Javanese poem Desavarnana, more commonly known as Nagar Kritagama, written in 1365, lists Temasek, which is modern Singapore, as one of the dependencies of Majapahit. Now, sadly, only a few buildings from the Majapahit kingdoms remain, and most of them in the village, really, of Trowulan in Java, eastern Java. What's interesting about these buildings is they represent an almost complete abandonment of stone as a building material in favor of brick. We have no explanation for the shift in this practice, but it is worth saying, however, that in other parts of Java in the 14th century, brick continued to be used. Stone continued to be used, and amongst the Majapahit ruins, we still find stone icons and some statuary. We also know, incidentally, from travel accounts that buildings in coastal Java, and Majapahit and Trowulan are still located further inland, were built almost exclusively of wood, which might explain why there are no standing structures from this period. Now, this particular image that we have here on slide 54 of the Bajangratu Gate I have very little to say for it because so little has been studied of it. It's about 50 feet high. An analysis of its iconographic program has led scholars to think that the gate was used to enter a holy building commemorating the death of King Jayanagara in 1328. And it's believed that he was reborn as Vishnu, or at least that is the tale that the iconographic program suggests. Slide 55, the other structures that are found in Majapahit, and this is literally it, I've labeled them. So it's Chandi Brahu and Chandi Tinkush, which I don't know why they still call it that, because it means the sort of rat breeding tank in Bahasa, which is obviously not what it was used for. It was a ritual bathing place. But I guess we just don't know what the old Javanese name for it was. There are possibly other structures for Majapahit in the Trowulan area, but also elsewhere. Evidence from a surface survey conducted in the early 90s points to the existence of manufacturing and long-distance trading activities within Trowulan itself. So again, we see this relationship between a highly well-defined here brick structure, a capital complex, but accommodating programs associated with trade that was coming long distance being from the coast into this more inland settlement. So, like I said, perhaps not the most satisfying note to end on, but end we do. And in the next class, we'll look at the Iberian world and the world system it creates in the 16th century and thereabouts. Thanks.